Good morning. May it please the Court, Bill Tice on behalf of Mr. Borzak. Mr. Borzak was sentenced to 70 years in prison, and principally the judge's rationale for that was that Mr. Borzak was certain to reoffend, to commit additional sex crime offenses. The court's statement, though, failed to account for or to even recognize certain important facts that were brought to light during the sentencing hearing. First and foremost, as this court knows, these offenses were incest offenses, and the record was pretty clearly made through the testimony of the psychologist and also through the literature that was brought to the court's attention, that it, certainly to me, it was very counterintuitive that incest offenders have a lower rate of recidivism. But, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I hadn't studied this before I came involved in the case. But that was certainly put before the court. Rather than dealing with that evidence, what happened was that the court essentially said, you're a really horrible person, you're really at risk to recidivate because you did this with your own children. So in fact, if the court dealt with the subject of incest, it dealt with it in an entirely wrong way by taking a position that was contrary to the evidence that was presented to the court. And this isn't even a case of someone carefully manicuring the record. That's the scientific literature that's out there. The government's expert never disputed that. And this court in Bradley and Miller has been pretty strong in saying that when a court comes to a sentencing with preconceptions that really have no support in the scientific literature, that's a problem. So it's not just that the court didn't really acknowledge the evidence about incest. The court went off on its own and came to some conclusions that really can't be supported.
Well, I thought, as I read the judge's remarks, that what he really did was reject Dr. Fogel's opinion as insufficiently reliable. He just didn't believe it. He didn't credit it. And so once that is excluded, the judge is basically on his own in evaluating the risk of recidivism and made some common sense assumptions about the defendant's lack of self-control, lack of remorse, lack of inability to come to grips with the deviance of his behavior, or willingness to acknowledge that, his lack of insight into the deviance of his own behavior based on what he told the police afterwards, and so forth. So that's how I read this. He decided whether to accept the expert's opinion, decided not to, excluded it, and then he was left with what is normally the case in the absence of expert testimony, which is to make some holistic conclusions based on the rest of the record.
It's certainly true that the court found problems with and perhaps even indeed rejected Dr. Fogel's testimony. I'd like to come back to that in a second. But I would say in a broader sense, even if you find that Dr. Fogel's testimony is not persuasive, or even if a judge finds that, the judge still has to deal with what else is in the record. I would not agree that the judge can say, oh, Fogel's out of the picture, I can now pursue whatever theories I have or whatever intuitions I have about sex offending. Because what Fogel had to say about the incest aspect was never challenged. The government's expert did not challenge it, and it is there. Now, I'd like to loop back very briefly to the judge's rejection of Fogel's testimony. As I understand the record, the judge felt that Fogel's testimony was not persuasive because it was confusing. When I first read that, I found that such a remarkable statement. Here's a judge in a non-jury proceeding saying, I find the testimony confusing. Not I disagree with it, but it's confusing. And I was thinking to myself, oh, my gosh, if the judge found it confusing, why didn't the judge probe and clear up the confusion? But we can go even further. What it seems that what the judge was concerned about was Fogel's position on pedophilia. And the Fogel was clear in saying, you know, there are all sorts of things that go into predicting recidivism. And Fogel rejected the idea that if you call someone a pedophile, therefore there's recidivism. He said you have to look at other things as well. And of course, that makes sense because you don't say someone is a recidivist or not a recidivist. Psychologists talk about risk of recidivism, and they've got percentages, and they've got ways of figuring out the percentages. And all Fogel was saying, if you're trying to make it sort of an on-off switch question, pedophile, non-pedophile, recidivist, non-recidivist, I reject that, said Fogel. And other than that, I it's really unclear to me what the district court was referring to when it said, I find his testimony confusing. As a matter of fact, I think that the court at some point is going to want to take a look at a very significant exchange in the sentencing hearing that takes place. Well, it certainly begins at page 52, but maybe the most significant exchange is page 61, where I'm not going to try to rehearse all that. I don't have the time in 10 minutes. But I think if you look at that, you'll see what I'm talking about. I know that my time is short, and I want to, unless the court has more questions about the procedural aspect, take a quick peek at the second issue in the briefs on the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. Obviously, one of the key points that we're raising here is that this sentence should have no presumption of reasonableness. It is not a within-range sentence. And I think we acknowledge pretty candidly in the briefs that this court has taken the position that, you know, if the guidelines compute to life, you can take the maximum sentence for each of the offenses and stack them, and anything less than that is within the guidelines. And there's no doubt that the court has taken that position, and I would suggest to the court that it needs to rethink that. And I'm not saying that because it's a matter of personal opinion or because some other circuit has taken a different view. But if you look at the guidelines, when the court decided Noel, it got it wrong. It looked at the wrong guideline. It looked at a guideline where there's only a single count of conviction. When you talk about multiple counts, there's an entirely different guideline that applies. And remarkably, the district court in this case, you can't really say that the district court followed the guideline that really should be looked at, because the district court gave 15 years on each of those four counts. Now, admittedly, the district court ran them consecutively along with another 10 years, but the court was certainly not following the guideline.
Stace, I respect your service as defense. I have a question for you.
Oh, sure.
And so I ask you this because you raised this on the objectively reasonable issue. What would you advance in a multiple count setting as the approach that a district judge should take, whether in this case or others?
Based on Section 3584, the statute, what the judge should be doing is saying there is a statutory presumption of concurrent time. And I've got to see something that is going to make me go beyond consecutive terms.
Are you suggesting something along the lines of what we require in the 3553 context, that a district judge speak to with some specificity
Yeah, the 3584 certainly enjoins the judge to look at 3553. And certainly one thing the court could be looking at, and this goes to another part of the brief, is what are typical sentences given in these cases. You know, it's really pretty remarkable that if you were to murder someone, your mean sentence would be a lot lower than what's here. And it all comes because of stacking.
Thank you, Mr. Chase. Mr. Percodney?
May it please the Court, Jeff Percanti on behalf of the United States. I'd like to take up Judge Sykes' statement that the district court was on his own after it rejected Mr. Fogel's report and conclusion. And, in fact, the district court was not on its own. On cross-examination, Dr. Fogel admitted that the defendant was a pedophile within the first six or seven questions on cross-examination. He then was asked about another forensic report that he had done in another case when he relied on the fact that the defendant in that case was a pedophile in determining that that person was likely to recidivate again in the future. So it's not that the district court was on its own. The defendant's own expert admitted that he was a pedophile. The defendant's own expert admitted that that condition is chronic, which means it doesn't go away. And our expert, Dr. Rogers, testified that a person who is a pedophile is not only going to have that condition for the rest of his or her life, but it also makes them more likely to recidivate. So it's not that the district court was on its own. It's that it rejected Dr. Fogel's argument or his conclusions and was left with completely uncontested testimony that the defendant is a chronic pedophile who is going to be a pedophile for the rest of his life, and that was going to that impacted his likelihood of recidivism. As for the statement that the district court was somehow confused by Dr. Fogel's testimony, I would suggest that, if anything, the district court was being kind there. I think the next statement that the district court made is very telling. When it rejected Dr. Fogel as being unreliable, based on this kind of waffling on the importance of the defendant being a pedophile, particularly given his prior testimony in other cases that pedophilia status as a pedophile was important. So frankly, I think when the district court said that it was confused by the testimony, I think what the district court was essentially previewing was its next sentence, and that is that this testimony was completely unreliable.
None of the experts in this case, either the defense experts or the government's experts, did the usual battery of psychological evaluations for risk of recidivism for a sex offender of this type, the sort of evaluations that are done for civil commitments, for example. I mean, that just wasn't part of this record.
Initially, Dr. Fogel did not, and our expert did not. Our expert was hired to kind of comment on what Dr. Fogel did. He did go back then and do an objective risk assessment test after he was criticized by the government's expert for not doing one. He did find that provided, I think, a low or mid to low level of a likelihood of recidivism. But it's important to point out that same test that he performed, he had also performed in the other case that we cross-examined him on, and found that the fact that the defendant in that case was a pedophile, even though he scored low on the same recidivism test, still made that person likely to reoffend again in the future. And I point out that other case that Dr. Fogel testified in was also an incest case. So what happened here really, what Dr. Fogel really did is provided no psychological opinion. His opinion was he didn't provide any diagnosis whatsoever. In fact, he said the defendant suffered from no mental illness at all, which was just not true. Then he went on to say that the reason I know that the defendant is not likely to recidivate in the future is that he's going to be able to be monitored, and because folks who engage in the similar type of offending, this incest type of offending, are less likely than folks who do not. There was no suggestion that he's going to be healed, that his pedophilia is going to go away. There was no statistics cited about the likelihood that this rehabilitation that he was supposedly going through was going to help him get over this in the future. None of that was cited. Instead, it was basically, we're going to be able to watch him in the future. It's going to be 15 years from now, so we're going to be able to even better watch people than we are now, and so he's not going to do this again.
Right, but risk assessments in these kinds of cases are tricky things. It's not just a matter of pronouncing that the disorder is, that the offender has recovered from the disorder. That doesn't happen. So what we had in this case is a defense expert who was discredited and by the government's expert who did not perform an independent psych eval but simply poked holes in the defense expert's opinion. And that served its purpose, so the defense expert was not credited or accepted. And so, you know, the judge was essentially in a position of having to take what was left of the record, which was that the defendant is a pedophile. That's a chronic condition. You don't recover from it. And it is a risk factor for recidivism and tends to correlate with recidivism. And that's as much as we've got here.
That's correct, Judge.
So that is what the judge, it seems to me, was basing his specific deterrence findings on, as much as anything else, which are just sort of, that's a non-scientific set of conclusions, because the scientific evidence was discredited.
Well, Judge, I do think, first of all, for procedural reasonableness, he considered other factors as well, obviously, and he stated those factors on the record. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing. With respect to specific deterrence and the need to protect the public, what was left is this uncontested idea that the defendant is a pedophile, that necessarily means he has a sexual interest in children. And our expert statement that pedophilia is an increased risk factor for recidivism down the road. That's what's left. And so I think that from that, when what he said was the defendant has an extreme sexual interest in children, which makes me conclude, the district judge conclude, that I need to protect the public from him in the future. And so I think for procedural reasonableness, given the kind of, as you, the court said, the hand he was dealt at that point, he went through all the factors. This is not a case like Bradley or Miller, where the district judge just kind of said, I think in my own mind that these folks tend to recidivate more than others.
My only point is that this was all stated at a high level of generality because nobody did a specific risk assessment that was actually accredited by the district court. So the judge was forced to fall back on generalities about pedophilia.
Absolutely correct, Judge.
Didn't the judge also make his own assessment, which you were supposed to do, that based upon the attitude of the offender and his, I don't think the word callous was used, but sort of indifferent attitude towards how he had harmed his children and felt, indeed, in fact, that it didn't harm his children, that attitude influenced the judge in his determination coupled with the other information?
He did, Judge, and he specifically referenced the post-arrest statement that was made by the defendant in which he clearly said that, or it was clear to the district court that he did not accept or understand exactly the kind of damage that he was causing to his own children when he was doing these acts for 3 years. So yeah, I think that is, and the judge said that first and then returned back to this idea that the defendant has this extreme sexual interest of children, and that's what the district court was concerned about. Turning to the second aspect, the substantive reasonableness, obviously this is an absolutely abhorrent case of a defendant who molested his own children for multiple years, and not only did that, but then memorialized it and sent it out over the internet to other people to permanently scar those children for life. I think that given this court's other decisions in Noel and other cases where no such physical contact occurred, upholding longer sentences, I believe 80 years in Noel, this sentence was certainly reasonable given the circumstances and conduct in this case. And if there are no other questions from the panel, I would ask that the court affirm the district court's sentence in this case. Thank you.
Guys, your time expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
First of all, I'd like to go back to a question that Judge Randa asked. It's certainly true that initially Mr. Borzek talked about this case or viewed this case in a really callous way, which from the little bit I've since learned is kind of common with child molesters. They have this crazy idea that the children are enjoying them, themselves. And he made statements to that effect when he was first arrested. But it was part of the record that he had weekly counseling sessions for more than a year, because he was locked up, I think, for maybe like 15 months before he was sentenced. And the treating psychologist related how Borzak had these views and continued to express these views, but during the course of counseling came to realize that these views were incorrect. Now, you know, it would be very easy to say, well, he's just saying that to get out of trouble. But the problem in this case is that the district judge only talked about the statements immediately after arrest. The district judge never said anything about the turnaround in Borzak's attitudes. And I would add to that that Fogel gave Borzak the MMPI and the PAI, I may have the acronyms wrong, which everyone agreed, even the government's expert, are objective tests that evaluate the subject's sincerity, honesty, if you will, and based on those, he felt when he examined Borzak in late 2010 that Borzak was dealing with this in an honest way. And yet the district court said nothing about that.
Finish your thought.
It's true, and I was kind of astounded at this myself, that nobody, although they talked about how Fogel had done the test, and then the government expert commented and said it was accurately done, nobody ever introduced the worksheets, and unfortunately that's not there. But I would ask the court to come back to the idea that the decision was made on the premise that he was certain to reoffend. And that sort of support is not there. You can say, I don't think much of Fogel's testimony. I find it confusing. Although I'm only being charitable, I didn't realize that was a way out. But
Mr. Tyson, if we have a situation, and the reason I solicit your views on this, is these sentences in these cases have been substantial. So if we have a case where it's only likely to offend, perhaps we could get more agreement in that area. Is it your position that if it's a diagnosis from either side or both sides that it's likely to offend, that considering a defendant's, particular defendant's, any defendant's age, you would argue that it has to be less than the equivalent of a life sentence? Is that really your position?
Right, because we're in these cases we're talking about a base rate of reoffense of like 13%. Take 100 child molesters over the course of 15 years, 13 of them will reoffend. And of course, it's horrible when those 13 reoffend. But I don't think we can say, which is essentially what happened below, we're going to lock up all 100 of those forever. You know, I don't really know what the doctors are telling me, but there's some chance, and so I'm on my own, and I'm going to just lock them up forever.
Well, then that speaks to the supervised release aspect, I guess. Because I know you referenced our recent decision on where we remanded.
On Quinn, yeah.
And your position, if this were not 85% of 70 is 60, roughly, right. If this were a 40-year sentence with 20 years of supervised release.
How about a 15-year sentence? I get your point.
I understand. But yeah. I'm just trying to get this into a realm of where we've had cases on these kinds of sentences. What you're suggesting is the view that we ought to take in the broadest sense on
reasonableness. I think you should be viewing supervised release as the backstop in many of these cases. And in this case, Borzak got supervised release for life with all these conditions, which seem like very reasonable conditions, except he'll never live long enough to be subject to them.
All right. Well, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Cotty. Mr. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.